Welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. It's not just for contracting officers. If you work anywhere in the government acquisition world, this podcast is for you. Whether you work for government or industry, we're here to help you understand just a little more about how the other side thinks. This episode is brought to you by Skyway Acquisition. Skyway gives you contacts from former contracting officers, just-in-time training in the government market, and consulting to solve your unique puzzles. Visit AskSkyway.com to learn more and see if you're a fit. The topic for today is effective teaming, and our Kevin Jans interviews Kevin Lothridge, who's the CEO of the National Forensic Science and Technology Center. The NFSTC provides test and evaluation and forensic services to the justice, military, and homeland security communities. Forensic science is a very specialized field that often requires the NFSTC to team with other companies to win government business. Let's get started as Kevin Lothridge shares his experience developing effective partnerships and learn how that can improve acquisition outcomes for both government and industry.
Hey there, this is Kevin Jams. I have an interesting podcast episode today. I have Kevin Lothridge from the National Forensic Science Technology Center. It's in Largo, Florida. And a very interesting company. The topic today is teaming, and they've spent a lot of time working on teaming and doing it well and having some challenges. So I invited Kevin onto the podcast to tell his stories. But before we get into that, Kevin, give us some background on how you ended up in the government market.
Sure, Kevin. The National Forensic Science Technology Center is a 22-year-old 501c3 not-for-profit that got its start when O.J. Simpson was driving his Bronco down the five in 1994-95. And at that time, the American Society of Crime Lab Directors realized they were probably not going to be able to handle the scrutiny that forensic science was about to get. Since if you think about 1995, it predates any of the 200 hours a week of TV shows, including the Forensic File Channel, where you get something called forensic science. So this was a 501c6. They gave us $1,500 in the mission to go do good things. To incorporate a nonprofit in the state of Florida in 1995, it cost $1,475. We took the other $25 and bought some beers and figured out what we were going to do because they said, don't come back for any more money.
That's awesome.
So 22 years later, we built the nonprofit to operate like a small business. We have been based in Largo our whole history, so that makes us kind of unique as a small business in the area. And our market space is unique in the fact that we market services to state, local, federal, and international governments.
So the topic today is teaming. And so specifically in terms of what are we talking about with teaming? Well, it's teaming on contracts, it's teaming for relationships. And so I'll let you talk about how do you define teaming, because it's something that you and I have talked about before that you guys do pretty well. So give me an idea of what do you see as the biggest opportunity and challenge in teaming?
Well, I will say the first thing that we look at for teaming is, can we get it local? Is there a small, a medium-sized, or a large business in the Tampa Bay region that we can work with on a project? Because it is much more cost-effective for me to get in my car and drive to my partner's location than to get on a plane and fly hours away to resolve a problem. When you have specified the quality of work that you want, you can probably find it in the Tampa Bay region. We've spent the last 22 years generating our local partnerships. So we have a tagline that is work local, and that has worked out so well for us. Unfortunately, in the teaming era, people don't necessarily do that. So if you look at the current contracts at SOCOM, for example, the swim series, while some of those companies are local or have a local office, one or two people, the majority of the work is not from the local area. So costs automatically go up. We live in the Tampa area where costs are low compared to, let's say, DC.
That makes a big difference too. That's a great point.
Well, and I think one of the other things about teaming is it's got to be the right relationship at the right time. If people believe there are exclusive relationships, totally exclusive relationships, that is not how business works. There are days that you're teammates, there are days that you're competitors, and there are days that you just want to partner on everything you possibly can because it gives the guys downrange the right tools.
Do you find yourself teaming more before the opportunity or after the contract is already underway and you need additional skill sets to bring to the table?
Well, both, actually. We're a niche of a niche. So one thing as a small nonprofit in the area is we have to remain focused. So we only work in the parameters of biometric and forensic intelligence and support services. So if somebody comes to us and said, hey, you got chemists, we want you to work on this R&D project, that's not in our best interest. Now, we'll put them with somebody that can do that work, maybe a university, maybe another small company that's got some really bright scientists. But our role would really be to do the test and evaluation for the biometric and forensic market space. And I think that's one of the key things about teaming is just because somebody offers you some butts in seat chairs, you may not necessarily want those slots because they could drag you away from the mission.
Yeah, we talk about targeting constantly. And I like how you phrase that. It drags you away from the mission. And whether it's the mission of your company, the mission of your customer, it's distraction. And a lot of times what we all need is not more opportunity. We just need fewer distractions. That's kind of the value of teaming is being able to send an opportunity that's a distraction for you and give it to somebody else. And
well, and I can tell you that early on during the mid-2000s, there were a lot of people that got in to support the government in forensics and biometrics. That wasn't their core competency. Many of those are still around, but most of them have left that service area simply because it did distract them from their main mission. Fortunately for us, that is our main mission. So anytime there is a biometric or forensic service, they either come to us or to somebody we know who may then want to team with us to provide the solution. And I think you'll see that in things like cyber and counter drone. Really, everybody will want to get into it first, but it's those that is their mission and their core passion. They'll be the ones that in the long term survive.
How do you find the right teaming partner? Do you have like a go-no-go strategy that you use?
I'm a big believer in relationships and vetting people for the right reason. It may be that there's a fit, but what's the long-term partnership going to look like? For example, if there was a piece of a large contract where we fit the bill, then my expectation is that's the piece we're going to get. We're not expected to grow into something that was not offered to us or was outside our core competency. Forensic and biometric services is a really small global community. So we know everybody globally in the forensic science business. So if it's somebody that's wanting to get into the business or wants to work with us, it's pretty easy enough to pick up the phone and talk to somebody that has either worked with them or knew the company or knew people that worked at the company before.
All right, so let's switch to the government side. So what does the government understand about teaming? And I'll just put it out there. As a contracting officer, I knew that teaming happened, but specifically how it happened and how important it was to a company's overall strategy. I mean, I didn't really see subcontractors. I didn't see teaming partners. And sometimes they called them teammates. And what they meant was they were part of their series of you know, supply chain or service subcontractors, right? And so from a government perspective, I don't necessarily understand the impact that things that I do as a CO have on your ability to team, or for that matter, your experience as a subcontractor, like what happens to you. So what is something that you wish the government knew about the teaming process that COs like myself probably don't know?
Well, one is to recognize that there is value in having people who have past performance that should be looked at. So if you say I'm on Team X, and Team X is made up of four components, then you should evaluate what service or what support you're looking to get in the lines of where the teammates fall. So for example, if I'm on a contract where it's biometric and forensic intelligence, you should look at the full capability of all the parts of Team X and see where together they're stronger than any one individual organization could ever be. And the contracting officers don't have that luxury. I'm sorry. It's a tough game these days for the contracting officers, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's really hard for us to be able to put the puzzle together based almost solely on what's in the proposal. I mean, a lot of times we don't know who those subs are. I'd see companies that were a subcontractor listed, and I'd never heard of the company. because they weren't big enough to be marketing to us, or they weren't big enough to have a booth at some event I went to, or for that matter, they just were they wanted to be small. They're only, you know, 5 employees that do a specialized thing that we just didn't see.
So for example, if you look at the changing nature of the task orders that come out, if you put one out that is requiring an organization to procure, integrate, acceptance test, and commission technology, the KO should have the ability to say to the team, prove to me that you have successfully done this. Today, what happens is, give us a draft acceptance test plan. And if you go query DoD acceptance test plans, you can probably go edit those and they all probably look the same. From the contracting officer's perspective, the best writer wins, not necessarily the best performer.
And what do you see as the best way to fix that? Is it in the task order process, or does it start sooner than that in the overall RFP process?
Give an example and make the people write to the example, almost a competency review.
Okay. And we used to do sample task orders back when I was doing a lot of the IDIQ contracts. We would do sample task orders, and then the idea was they may actually be real. In fact, what I usually would do would have like 4 samples, and then one of them was actually real. What evaluation criteria would you want to see in an RFP that would allow the industry to understand how to explain that to the contracting officer in a way that goes deeper than the task order?
Talk to a customer that they did the same work for.
There you go. There's that communication thing again.
Really read the C pars. That's a great thing for a team or a small business to understand. I have the right to be reviewed. I know that I don't want to upset the customer, but I would have to say at the end of this contract, I need my CPARs.
Yeah. And to be able to say what you're going to do with it, how it's going to help the customer next year or next decade or whatever, is that when I get a good CPARs or an effective CPARs, I can use that to come back and help you again. So that's for the program managers who listen, that's a really good message of, you know, what's in it for everybody when the CPARs gets done and gets done well and gets done properly on time.
Well, Kevin, I want to throw this back to you as a contracting officer. If you had 3 CPARs on tasks that were almost the same, and 2 said did okay, and the other one said, if I knew what now, I would definitely award again, I'm saying the one is probably better than the other 2.
Yeah, you're looking for better than satisfactory, because satisfactory can be interpreted to mean, okay, they showed up. And this is a judgment thing. Some COs would say they showed up and did the job satisfactory. Other ones say, oh, well, they didn't blow the doors off, so by definition, they met what they were supposed to. Well, there's a difference between those two, right? That's probably one of the biggest challenges is how do you interpret the subjective side? And that's honestly, that's why the contractor gets a chance to actually respond to a CPARS.
And they should seek to understand how to be better. The thing that everybody is average and we should shoot for average goes against corporate culture and the way people should do business.
Yeah. That's a really good takeaway from the CPARS, is how can you get better from it? And that's why we push people to get and give debriefings as often as they can and have as much communication, because if they don't know what they did wrong and they don't know how to make you happier, then they're probably not going to make you happier next time, if they even get a next time.
I think the other thing is, as far as teaming goes, everybody needs to be honest and share their CPARs. Maybe they're not all great, but at least if we know it, we can write to the strengths and explain the weakness.
Yeah, what's that? There's a proposal saying that if you have a problem, you feature it, or you find it, you fix it, and then you feature it. And you say, okay, here's a problem, here's my mistake, and this is how I fixed it. And then you come out and just tell everybody, this is how I fixed it. Do you think people tend to protect their dirty laundry when they're looking for teaming partners?
I think you should be honest about that, because it could be that one of your teammates did work for the command that was not above average, or maybe been a little bit below average. That affects everybody in the team, where that may not be one of the examples you want to use as a past performance.
Yeah, something as simple as choosing which past performance, you got to be straight up. So those are the ways that the government can impact the teaming side. So from the industry side, do you have any stories on what you've done well when you're teaming? And then, of course, what really helps people is what you've done poorly when you've done teaming.
number one is when you've been the prime on a contract and it gets rebid and you're on the team and now you're the sub, while you can still tell people you've done the task, it's better to assume your new role and be a real part of the team. Not, I could have done it better, I would do it different. And that actually bears out a lot. If you have the right staff, you're not rebadging them, they may still end up being the site lead, for example, on a contract that you're now the sub on.
That happens a lot, doesn't it? I mean, especially as a small business, that's the way things work.
Well, if you're not the prime on one of the large contracts now, it definitely is.
So tell me more about the things you've learned from doing this for 22 years of trying to find the right teaming partners.
Trust is number one. Number two is play your role, play to your strengths. If they ask you to do something on the team you're not strong on, don't be afraid to say, I can't do that. And I think lastly is help the other teammates if they need help. So one of the things that we did, we started doing work which required security clearances. We are a nonprofit in forensic science. That was probably not high on our list, but I knew that we needed to do it. So we actually brought in a consultant, converted the consultant to a staff member, and now we actually sell facility security officer services to other companies.
Because you saw it as a need among the teammates you had?
Yep. The smalls that we were bringing together, some of them, this is the first contract that may require a 254 and holding clearances.
So yeah. So you're bringing a service that you figured out through your teaming that people who are just a little bit smaller than you actually needed.
And sometimes people bigger than us like to have somebody as a deputy FSO or something. And it helped me drive my overhead costs down. It's all about cost and providing the service. And that really worked well for us. You'd ask me about things we didn't do so well teaming. Coming from the nonprofit world, in the early days of doing work for DOD, our accounting system was not what DCMA or DCAA would look at. So we've actually converted over to using one of the large software packages meant for DCAA, DCMA. And that's a struggle, right? The contracting officer may want to award something, but they can't if you don't meet all the wickets that are required.
And did you find that was a value for you among your other teammates, the fact that you had you'd gone through the investment of getting yourself DCAA compliant?
Well, it is. The other thing is you won't be on the team if you're not. So for us, we learned that we had to talk to people and realize that the scale would not necessarily be the same as people we were talking to. So we had to figure our way down to how does it work for an organization of 50 people versus an organization of 1,000 people?
Is there a right size for teams? Is it 3 companies, 5 companies, 50? I mean, where does the critical mass outweigh the value?
It depends on what the contract is that you're teaming on. I'm on some with 10, 15 because we're in swim lanes and within our team. A lot of times we're building a team where we're bringing people in because they have specific expertise that we're not working in this market space. There is no way one company by itself could do everything. So for example, if it was a $30 million forensic test and evaluation training consulting contract, I would have no problem going at that by myself if I had all the wickets in the task order covered. But if the KO says there's a subcontracting plan, small business requirements, then I can't do it by myself. I have to go look for those things to meet the requirements of the contract.
So by adding specific requirements to the contract, the KO could be forcing you into teaming when you could do all the work, but you can't execute all the stuff in the contract.
I would not have good CPARs if I did not meet the goals that were set forth in the contract.
It's important for companies to understand that it's not just, hey, let me look at my Rolodex and see who I can get to team on this contract. It's a lot more than that.
I think times are changing on the Rolodex of who I used to work with, who I knew when I was doing government work or served with, or this guy seems like a good guy. It's really now about how can we be as competitive and successful as individual companies while we work together as we possibly can.
And that's a great thought to wrap it up on. So if people want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to contact you, Kevin?
I think if they actually go to www.nfstc.org, all of our contact information is there. Things about our space. We have a lot of video content. To shoot me an email, I'd be glad to talk to them. It's kevin.lothridge@nfstc.org.
Well, thanks for being on the podcast, Kevin. I look forward to running into you other places in Tampa. And in the meantime, have a great day.
All right, thanks.
Okay, that's it for this episode of the Contracting Officer Podcast. Help us spread the word about the podcast by telling a friend, and we can all make government contracts better one contract at a time. Thanks for joining us.